Welcome to Ron Paul, the weekly podcast. I'm Charles Goyette. Many young men have gone off to Washington pledging to serve the philosophy of limited government, fiscal responsibility, and the Constitution. But since the 1970s, Ron Paul has distinguished himself by his steadfast adherence to those ideals. How did he do it, and what was it like? What kind of conditions did he encounter in Washington? What kind of pressures did he endure in Congress? And how can we be sure of the commitment of others that we send off in the future? Ron, a New York Times profile wrote about you that you were on the lonely end of a lot of 434-1 votes in Congress. Was it lonely?
Well, in a way, it was lonely in Washington, but I never felt lonely in the sense that I was all by myself in the whole world, because it was the issue that distinguished me outside of Washington. And at the beginning, when I first went to Washington in the 1970s, I thought this would be very strange and I wouldn't be reelected and all. But the support was very strong, not only in the district, but people were actually looking for somebody willing to buck the status quo. And therefore, the loneliness in Washington didn't really bother me that much. Matter of fact, I think voting by oneself, I did separate from, you know, just associating with other colleagues. I might have been, as others have said, been too generous with my colleagues, but I generally gave them the benefit of the doubt. And I usually mumble to myself, well, they had a bad economics teacher, or they learned their foreign policy from government schools, and I wouldn't get too upset with them, and got along with them fairly well. But I thought my job as a congressman was to vote my oath of office and whatever I promised in my campaigns. And that produced a comfort level for me. A lot of people wondered, how can you do it, and how did you manage that? Well, I think it's strictly a comfort level. If I wouldn't have voted that way, I'd have been miserable with myself and not satisfied at all. Others go, and their views are very superficial, or they're different, and they believe in interventionism and planned economies, this mixture of big government and limited government, and they see this as a very positive thing. And to get ahead, you have to go along to get along, and you got to be a member of the team. So their comfort level is very, very high. It's just that I rejected that from the very beginning, because I believed it was that type of compromise to go along was the problem we had in this country. And if you did this on occasion, soon it became the whole system. And I believe that's what's happened to us in the last 40 or 50 years or even longer, that the rule of law has been abused and the Constitution has had less and less meaning. And quite frankly, I believe that's why we're in the mess we're in today.
Well, how did the leadership treat you in the leadership in the party? What kind of pressures were you subjected to go along, to get along? I mean, when did they realize that you were different and they were wasting their time?
About a week or two after I was there. I remember the first week I was there, and I had a bill I wanted to be introduced and worked with. So I went to the chairman of the committee and told him about it. I probably had something to do with the Fed. And the immediate reaction was a shock to me. He says, well, what are you going to give me? I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, what vote are you going to promise? He wanted me to promise that I would vote against all my beliefs and convictions, and if they needed help, that I would go along with them. So they wanted, it was always, you know, a trade. So obviously that was not the way I did it. So the leadership generally left me alone. You know, they didn't bother. And fortunately, the lobbyists left me alone too. They didn't come because they knew I wasn't going to change my mind. So some people claim that, you know, it's the pressure. And they do put a lot of pressure. There was one night, I imagine you might even remember this, many people would, the night we passed prescription drug program. The voters started at 2 in the morning and probably finished about 4:30 or something, arm twisting and badgering. They had to reverse the vote. And they did. They finally reversed the vote by just, really hounding a guy until he finally gave in. But they didn't talk to me that night, because I would have just sat there and listened and not said a word and then gone and voted the way I was supposed to. So it is really tragic, the mess that we're in and how the votes are bought and sold and why people go there. But basically, I think it's because they lack any strong fundamental belief and understanding what a free society is all about and how to use the Constitution in a correct manner to protect that. And that's just not important to them. Matter of fact, as it's a reflection of our educational system, that the Constitution not be, as they say, overly rigid. We don't want it to be rigid. Well, I happen to think the rule of law ought to be rigid and that people's rights should be protected. But they're conditioned that way through school, and so they don't lose any sleep over what they do. They go to bed at night figuring, well, I've done my best to make it a better world, not realizing they're really playing into the hands of the powerful elite who love the Fed, who love inflation, who love the war, who love to be the dictators. And then there's so many who go along. Matter of fact, the people have to go along with all this, too. There's a bunch of people out there like to be taken care of, and others claim, well, I guess we have to do this. And they don't argue it on principle, and because they haven't thought it through. So if anything, we need more people to understand the basic principles of what a free society is all about and what natural rights mean, why individuals have rights and not groups. And when we have that, and once it's discovered that the system we have is totally bankrupt, literally and intellectually, you know, things will change. But I think we're in transition, so that's why I tend toward optimism that the message is getting out, because the opportunity is there. This system of government intervention and inflation and debt and fighting endless wars, those days are coming to an end. It should be good news. The real challenge is, what are we going to replace it with? This system will not last. And it is up to many of us to participate in getting the people to understand why a new crop of politicians argue the case for less government and not for the case of the nanny state, where the government is going to have a safety net, so-called, for everybody, and everybody will be taken care of. I mean, this Obamacare might be really the issue that breaks the back of this whole system, because even, I think it was just recently, the unions are reporting that they sort of don't like this Obamacare. It's not helping their medical care. So when left and right come together and are getting tired of government, and that's you could argue that case on foreign policy. There are coalitions on left and right are sick and tired of these wars and spending overseas. So that is what has to happen. And the revolution has to involve a whole cross-section of a political system. You just can't have total changes by getting 51% of the Republican primary voters to support something. That won't work. And I think that I see at least a lot of positive things happening, where a lot of young people especially have an intense interest in understanding why personal liberty works, and they cannot depend on the government to take care of them. They might have gotten a student loan, but now they don't have a job and they're seriously wondering what's really going on.
Well, in contrast with our relative optimism today, was there ever a time during your long years in Congress that you were, when were you most discouraged about freedom's prospects?
Well, you know, I never had a moment like that. I think at the beginning, I was very discouraged about the trend, you know, and that was in the 70s, matter of fact, when I saw the opening up of unlimited big government, when they eliminated any restraint on monetary authorities. And that, of course, was the dislinking the dollar from gold. I figured, well, now everybody's going to get what they want, and they can print this money forever until it collapses. So I was very negative on it there, and didn't run to be in office as much as run to try to warn people that this system can't last. But overall, most people said, well, how did you put up with it, you know, in Washington? You went there, you voted right, and you did all these things, but nothing really happened. And you had to listen to that and watch it, watch the whole system continue down the wrong path. And I think that was true to a certain degree. But I more or less half kiddingly say, well, I was never discouraged, and I didn't become more negative. I said I was just realistic. I had low expectations and figured it would take a while. But that's finally changed from very low expectations and much opportunity to change anything to what has evolved in these last 40 years, where the economic fallacies of the Keynesian system is readily apparent, and the endless wars that people are getting tired of it. So my expectations are much higher. So I went probably at the beginning, I had the lowest expectations and the most pessimism, when really nobody was even thinking about it, because, you know, still there was a fair amount of prosperity in the country, and we didn't have nearly 50 million people on food stamps and all the problems that we are faced with today.
Well, we've learned over the years that we need to be skeptical, even cynical, about other political candidates. How do we judge their fidelity and their devotion to principle when they offer themselves up as candidates?
Well, that is a tough question to answer, because I actually have been stung a few times over the years. But I've never, at least early on, I never, you know, had the litmus test and said, well, I'm not going to try to help anybody unless you have 100% agreement with the philosophy of liberty and you have to accept what I say. I figured, you know, openings, I believe in coalitions. I would work with liberals who knew something about civil liberties and were anti-war. But there were a few that would be candidates who would come to my office quite frequently and make their case if I'd only endorse them and help them out. They would come and help me out. But it didn't happen too often. There are several that did it, but more now than it was in the past. But they and it didn't take me long to figure out where they would go. Would they stick with me and some of the things that I advocated, or would they quickly drift off in the other direction? Most of them did, and you could tell within a week or two at the votes, because they were still trying to get on their committees and their assignments and getting their special benefits for their district, and they wanted to look important. So they immediately would go along with leadership, whatever leadership told them to do, they would do it. And it was a pragmatic decision for them. They say, well, I can't have everything. The best we can do is try to get the Republicans to, you know, balance the budget and all those wonderful things that they talked about. So they would, but they'd reveal themselves rather quickly. But I don't work on the assumption that all of a sudden within every election and every 2 years that we're going to get 10, 20, and 30 new members and finally build up until we have a majority and we're going to pass laws only to repeal the bad laws and cut spending and cut tax. I don't think that's going to happen. I still believe in the political action, that the more people you have there, the better, so that they can use it as a bully pulpit and talk about it and set some standards. But my belief is that people's minds have to be changed, as so many of the supporters I've had over the years helped change the mindset about the Federal Reserve. And we actually had that bill to audit the Fed passed twice in the House of Representatives. But that was changing the people's mind and not in Washington. And I think that is where the action is. And when the people's minds are changed because they realize government doesn't work, then those few in Washington will have some help, because the other ones will be pressured into it. Those individuals who voted to audit the Fed, finally, they didn't do that because all of a sudden they understood monetary policy. They did it because they finally realized their people at home are saying, hey, this is important to us, and we want you to vote for it. And they figured there was no political liability for doing this. So ultimately, the world and our country would change, and Washington will change, when the people change their minds about dependency on government.
Well, thank you, Dr. Paul, for changing people's minds and for the enlightenment that you have provided to people that are eager to learn about freedom and sound money and the Constitution. Another great conversation and podcast. Ron Paul, The Weekly Podcast. I'm Charles Goyette.